Hello, everybody, and welcome to the War Room. This is a PFL 2023 Championship special. And what I'm going to do today is I've been editing a few clips for the broadcast that we're working towards right now. And I'm going to show you the clips. I'm going to animate them. I'm going to take a little bit more time than I would do normally on these, because I know you hardcore fans on the channel like a bit more information when it comes to these analyses. And we have had some fantastic performances this year. We've had some standout stars. We've had some people come back into the regular season as former champions of other years. And just, I mean, Larissa Pacheco is absolutely terrifying. I'm going to go through the six championship bouts on the card in no particular order, and just kind of talk you through some of these fights, because, well, the fight's coming up, Black Friday, and there's a lot at stake. You know, people are going for second titles, going for first titles. People that have been close to titles before are now in contention. We've got new contenders. I mean, you know, it's an exciting time to be a part of PFL, because I can feel the momentum that we've got on our side. And I want to talk you through some of these very impressive performances. So I'm going to first start with Jesus Penedo against Gabriel Braga. So both of these guys came into the PFL and fought one another in their first fight. And it was a really close back and forth. It was a split decision to Braga. But it was a real battle. It was a real, you know, they both gave good accounts of themselves. And I both think, especially as young fighters, they're going to take something away from it that's going to make them better in this championship bout. Not only the knowledge that they have of one another, but also the fact that they've both had really good successes since, and kind of further realize their own potential and their capabilities. Very, very dangerous technical fighters. So Pinedo's coming in with a record of 22 wins, 6 losses and 1 draw, and Gabriel Braga is undefeated at 12-0. So I'm going to quick show you a couple of clips from their first fight. So it was a bit of a fight of two halves for me. What we saw was Gabriel Braga establish a really good low kick game early on, and because Pinedo's very heavy on his lead leg and can be very aggressive, it seemed to unsettle his game in the early rounds. What you'll see here is when Braga starts, he starts chopping away at these hard low kicks. And, you know, and he's very fluid in his stance as well. He's very good at switching from one stance to another and from kicking from one side to the next. But you can see how this was starting to take the base away. Let's just go back and have a look at a couple of these. Like, even on this one, you can see where Pinedo's picked his leg up because he's anticipated it. Because it's caught him on the ankle, it kind of kicks his hip in a weird sort of way, and it doesn't allow him to throw that counterpunch with any value. You can see how it falls short. And you can see how he kind of hops on it a little bit. He's visibly showing that he's hurt, which is something that the judges are going to note, certainly something that Braga's going to note, which is going to increase his enthusiasm going forward, and a lovely low kick to follow up. But then, you know, Pinedo does really good work off the fence. He's very good at swarming his opponents, which is what we saw against Brendan Loughnane, and really good at attacking up the center line. Like, look at these swarming hooks. Like, because he's big for the weight class, and because he's got such good long range strikes, like when he starts this combination, like, I mean, look at the length of his arms here compared to Braga's. Like, he just looks and feels like he's at a closer range than Braga is. So when he starts throwing, there's no option really for Braga to do anything other than to move back away from this power. Like, straight away, this awkward left kind of, it's kind of a left shovel punch. It's a really unusual one. Clips him across the chin. But before he's even begun to recover from that shot, the next shots are coming. Hook over to the side of the head, swarms him. And then, of course, here comes the clinch with the knee, which is something that was really, really effective against Brendan Loughnane. But this aggression is going to be really, really useful in this next fight. And if Braga can, of course, you know, debilitate that lead leg and slow him down, it's going to make it easier to get away from him when he does start sprinting. But if I'm Pinedo, I'm taking a lot of confidence from the way that this fight was going towards the end. Look, even walking through these low kicks, and you can see Braga's trying to use this now as a defensive tactic. And he lands it hard, and it kind of turns the knee in, but the determination of Pinedo is just going to keep pushing and working through. And now you can see him squeeze right up against the fence where Pinedo is just going to start unleashing, like, fast, confident strikes with long arms, working to the body hard as well. Like, he's got a real good hustle. So what I expect from this fight is, of course, you know, 25 minutes. We've got an additional 10 minutes for this to play out. I think Braga's going to start tactically, like he did last time. I think he's going to keep switching his stance and be expecting those rushes off the fence, but do what he can to debilitate that lead leg. The thing is, because he did so much damage to the lead leg in the first round, it was evident in the second and third. So even when Pineda was starting to be aggressive and land his own shots, you can still see him kind of stumbling and struggling on that leg, which does have an impression on the judges. If I'm Braga, I'm thinking I need to do damage to that lead leg early, so then I can utilize his impaired movement for the rest of the 20 minutes, for the rest of the 25 minutes, of course. If I'm Pinedo, I need to use a bit more footwork. I need to maintain the movement and the mobility in my legs. I don't want to be there being chopped down by Braga in the first round. I don't want to be there trading punches with him and taking those calf kicks and then have to deal with it for the rest of the fight when my legs aren't moving properly. If he's got a bit of movement and he can stay behind a long jab and a long cross and keep mobile and then rush into range with those flurries, hooks and uppercuts followed by knees, that's where he's going to catch Braga. It's the changing of the pace and the rhythm for Pinedo and the consistent, steady chopping away from Braga. But again, the last time these guys faced one another, it was a close fight, and they've both had really, really impressive victories since then. They've both beat former champions and former challengers, and they've both realized the potential that they have, and now they have an opportunity to become a world champion and a millionaire in one night. So it's a big night for these guys, and the reason why I love this format is because you had so many veteran fighters in this division, the likes of Chris Wade and Bubba Jenkins and Brendan Loughnane, of course, last year's champion, who are now no longer in the picture, and we've got the fresh blood that's replaced them, which it gives the old guys something to kind of reinvigorate themselves, right? Now, Brendan Loughnane knows that if he's going to come back and win the belt next year, he's got to raise his game to the level of these new prospects, these new faces in the PFL. And I feel like that's going to be beneficial for everybody because, you know, everyone's game is going to be raised and we as the fans are going to get to benefit from watching it. Okay, right, next fight. Where are we? I think we're moving on to Larissa Pacheco now. Yeah, we are. Terrifying, terrifying individual. So she won the lightweight championship last year. She's come back, and this year she's going for the featherweight championship. And she's making it look rather easy, I have to say. Now, of course, she's got the intimidation factor. She's a scary individual. She's got this presence no matter where she is, and her opponents feel it, especially the likes of Elena Kolesnik, who's had the privilege of fighting her a few times. This was the third fight, and this was Larissa Pacheco basically just trying to get out the building as quickly as possible, I think. She was just so aggressive and so accurate. And it's a very basic game that she utilizes to win her fight. She's got a very good ground game, but she really uses it. She might have to win this fight against Mokhnatkin, and we will see if Marina can get the fight to the floor. But in the striking range, I honestly don't see anybody on the planet in featherweight or lightweight being able to deal with Larissa Pacheco. Like, she moves through range very well, but what she also does is she plants her back foot very well. So when she powers that right hand through, there's a whole support network from the knuckles all the way to the back foot, which is in contact with the canvas. And in this fight against Kolesnik, she throws the right hand to get her moving back and then rocks herself away to then spring back into range to land again. Watch what I'm talking about. See how she rocks herself out. It's a lovely movement. And it's because she knows that most likely Kolesnik's going to be moving back and swinging hooks, which is what happened in their first fight. That was the only time, really, we've seen Pacheco look vulnerable in the striking range, was in the first fight against Kolesnik, where she kind of got clipped, being a little bit lazy on the inside. Kolesnik comes sprinting forward, and then Pacheco, there's that right hand on the counter. Very, very useful going forward and backwards, but pay attention to the way that she moves. Let me slow it down. See how she rocks herself out of range of that hook. It's amazing. Long punch. Throws this lead hand to occupy the lead hand of Kolesnik, just to kind of keep her busy for a second. Throws the right hand. Falls just short. Really fortunate for Kolesnik. But then as she's moving forward, you can see Kolesnik's dropped this, and this hook's coming back around. So you know that she's going to be searching for this counter hook as Pacheco's moving forward. And as she throws it out, watch. Pacheco just drops away. She drops herself out of range at the same time as bringing her back foot up and digging it back into the canvas. So when she reestablishes this right hand, it's going to go straight through the target. It's a very subtle movement, but if you watch it slow down, you can see the benefit. Right hand, slip away, right hand, bang. And this, I mean, the next punch is not necessary. I'll tell you this firsthand because Kolesnik told me this the day after. It broke her nose. The first clean punch that landed, we've got a slow-mo from the other angle and you'll see it. Look how she dips out the way of that. Weight on the front foot, pushes back off the front foot and skips the back foot in as she's slipping the punch. Bat, bam. Incredible. And you can see Kolesnik's eyes spinning there. Like that other punch just lands kind of on the gloves. Not really necessary. This is the punch that does the damage. Look at the extension from the back foot. We're looking at this extension all the way from this back foot, which is powering this right hand through. Turns over, heels up. You can see right behind Boba Fett's head. Heels up. You can see that this is earthed, is the way I like to explain it, like a lightning rod for a building. Look at that punch right on the nose. Bam. Scary, scary individual. Now, of course, she's got a really tough test in front of her in Marina Mokhnatkina, someone that's got the grappling skills to compare and the takedown ability to potentially cause Pacheco issues, especially over 25 minutes, especially because Pacheco doesn't really like cutting to 145. I do feel like she is suited to this weight class, but I feel like she feels heavier and stronger at 155. So if I'm Mokhnatkina, I'm going to use my speed and my pace against her. I'm going to try and hustle her in the clinch as much as I can because that's the safest place to be with her punching power. And Mokhnatkina is very, very good at wrapping people up and tripping them and dragging them to the floor, which is where her Sambo background comes into play. You can see this here against Laybrock. So first of all, what we're seeing is we're seeing this overhook on the arm. But you can also see that Laybrock's kind of framing across her face, making it very uncomfortable and making it difficult for her to connect this hip here. This is really what Marina wants to do. She wants to bring the hips together so she can start to destabilize the base. But the sequence that she uses to get this takedown is lovely. Watch this. So she digs an underhook. She's going to drag her along the fence. And when she catches her step in, she's going to hook that leg and drag her to the floor. Let me show you again. Because there are so many things going on in this moment, right? She's going to drag Amber along the fence here, knowing full well that as she's moving along, she's going to keep reestablishing this foot. And you can see that she's looking down at these feet. She's looking down at the base. So as she's dragging her along here with the overhook and the underhook, strong on this back arm, look, dragging her along. As she's doing it, she's paying attention to what Laybrook's doing with her right foot. And she's going to step this right foot in, and then Mokhnatkina is going to go behind it, hook. And she's going to hook that at the same time as pulling down on this shoulder. You can see how she's got that hook right over the top of that shoulder. She's got a good grip of the deltoid. So as she's hooking this leg and removing this base, bringing her opponent down to the canvas, there's nothing that Laybrock can do to get this arm out. She is being dragged to the canvas. And Mokhnatkina is using her own body weight to encourage the drag. Look at that. Beautiful work. Like, you've got to think, if this leg wasn't trapped, Laybrock would have stepped this out and got herself a base over here. And then, of course, she could have either taken top position or perhaps maintained the fight on the feet, but she wasn't. She was taken down. Mokhnatkina is straight away to side control, where she's going to wrap up this armbar control. Lovely hook here. And a really good job of bumping Laybrock back over to get her onto her back. Like, a supreme awareness of upper body attacks. And honestly, if I'm dealing with Pacheco on the floor, I don't want to be dealing with her lower body, because although she's a power puncher, the power comes from her lower body. I want to be as far away from her legs as possible. Mokhnatkina, being a Sambo specialist, is going to be focused on isolating shoulders and arms. And this is, you know, an ideal game plan, especially to keep someone moving, keep them scrambling, and potentially make them tired over 25 minutes. She's got this really nice hook on the arm here, at the same time as she's throwing some hammer fist, just to try and get, because you can see Amber here has got this arms folded position, which is very difficult to separate when you're trying to work on an arm bar. But if you can hit somebody in the face a few times, you might just get them to do this, and then that arm becomes easier to isolate. So there's a clear game plan here. Hammer fist, hammer fist, hammer fist. And then when she feels the right opportunity, she's going to plant her arm out here. Oop. rolled past it. She's going to plant her arm out here, and she's going to throw her leg over to the other side. This is going to allow her now to start pressuring down to start pulling that armbar grip apart. Here she is, legs over. Now, Laybrook does the right thing. She's going to bridge over. She's going to try and get to her knees. But using this leg that goes across the midsection, Mocknatkin is going to drag her back over onto her back. Again, she's still got the arm isolated. She's still hooked onto that armbar. So you can see here, she's going to drop to her side and she's going to wrench that arm and kick with this leg. She's throwing her over with this leg across her midsection, across her stomach, and hooked on to the arm all the way through. So as she falls over onto her back, you can see that this arm is still isolated and controlled by Mocknatkina. And, you know, fair play to Laybrook. She's still got this arms folded position, which is really good defensively. And she's going to try and hook the leg, but eventually Mocknatkin is just going to utilize this, the pressure down from this knee right into the side of the head. At the same time, she's turning her head away from her and pulling the arm to separate. It's let me tell you firsthand, this is not a nice position to be in. You're left with very few positions, the hitchhiker escape being one of them, which is the one that I ended up having to use quite a lot in my career. You're already hyperextending the arm here, so there's little time before it either dislocates or the person taps. And Mocknatkina knows this. She's got a great position here. She's hyperextending this elbow. She's driving up with her hips. She's driving down with her leg, and she's driving down with her arm here. So there's the hyperextension in the elbow. You can see she's forcing it over the fulcrum of her hip. There we go. Lovely technique. Really nice. Really nice. Okay, who did I put in the videos next? Where are we? Should have a running order, shouldn't I? Heavyweights. Okay, Denis Goltsov. So, one of the most experienced fighters on the card, 32-7 against 11-3 in Henan Fajeda. So, Goltsov's got probably the best jab in mixed martial arts, especially in the heavyweight division. It's just so kind of patient and bam, accurate. It's like a piston coming out from his left hand. And the thing that I love about this finish against Jorgen De Castro is the way that he just kind of circles him. He just kind of pivots around him, utilizing his jab to square Jorgen De Castro up onto his heels. So when he uncorks this right hand, there's nothing behind him to stop him falling back. I'll just play it through full. So here we go. So there's the first jab out of the darkness. There's one jab. There's two jabs. And then there's the right hand. I mean, bang, bang. So this is the second jab that we're seeing here. As the second jab fires, what you're going to notice is this leg's going to start drifting around to the side. I've got a top position, which you'll see as well. You can see he's utilizing this like kind of big turns on the clock face. He's going from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. in one pivot. And this is really nice because he's keeping the feet of Jorgen De Castro in line as he's moving. So watch this. Big jab. Watch how he spins himself. So he's currently facing this direction. He's going to turn. Now he's facing this direction. He's changed his angle. But he's changed his angle but at the same time leaving Jorgen De Castro on a tightrope, because he's avoided the shot that he's thrown. So when Goltsov throws this cross now, De Castro is in the worst position to receive it. Like, look at that. I mean, there's nothing in this space here. There's nothing stopping him falling back. This is why you need a back leg. But because he's on this tightrope, because he's stuck here as the force comes through, he's just forced over his own center line. There's really nothing he can do about it. And the perfect setup and footwork from Goltsov to put him in this position. Here we go. Look at this top position. So, say this is a clock face, right? So what we got? So we'll have noon there, we'll have 6 there, we'll have 3 there, and we'll have 9 there, right? So right now, Goltsov's facing what? 4 o'clock? 4 o'clock? What do you reckon? He's going to throw a jab, facing 4 o'clock, pivoting around through to 5 o'clock, and now he's going to be facing 6 o'clock on one jab, right? Let me just remove these lines. But look at the line. It almost runs perfectly with the regular season banner. Look at the line that he's now caught Jorgen De Castro on. So when this right hand, which is cocked, which is right behind the microphone here, when this right hand comes firing straight down, there's nothing behind Jorgen De Castro to help him withstand this power that's coming at him. And also, of course, Goltsov's not only jabbed himself into the right angle, but he's also jabbed himself into the right range. So he's moved himself closer to his opponent's center line as well. Lovely. I love this angle. It's so interesting to see how fighters move around one another and how they utilize the space. This is slow-mo, but I'm going to slow-mo the slow-mo. Let's go crazy. Watch this. Jab. Little pivot. Cross. Lovely. Brings his feet together as well. I mean, that's a hard punch. That is a concussion response when the legs go stiff like that. Perfectly placed punch. Very, very efficient. Straight down the pipe. Lovely, lovely work. But of course, he's fighting Henan Fajeda, who is one of, I mean, he is the problema. He is one of the biggest problems that any heavyweight in the world could face right now. Not only size and speed, but his technical ability. I mean, I'm just kind of showing you the clips now. Let's go back and talk about what we've just seen. So with Henan Fajeda, especially since he's moved to American Top Team, and you can imagine a place like American Top Team with the coaches that they've got, the experience that they've got, especially with heavyweights, they're going to look at this guy walk in the door at, where is he, 6'5", something like that, massive reach, and they're going to think, right, let's add this to his game, and let's add this to his game, and I think he'll be good at this. And he's a project for the whole gym, this guy, because he's young enough to absorb this stuff. He's early enough in his career. He's not taking the battle damage that some of these heavyweights do, and he is flying right now. Like, so in this fight here, the distance that he covers with this rear kick is incredible. And the reason why I left it in is because of his advantage of range. So watch this. Big long kick, steps through and then rechambers it for a second go. And when I'm watching this, I'm watching the feet, right? I'm watching to see how much distance he covers based on the whole space in the smart cage. I'm seeing this back foot right now on the E of the regular season, right? And I'm seeing his opponent just in front of the black line that goes around the center shield. What we're going to see right now is this leg is going to fly through into range, but then it's going to come back and place down. Now, the position that he lands this back foot is further past the front foot of his opponent after he throws the kick. Let me say that again. His back foot is further forward than his opponent's front foot after he's thrown the kick. So he's not only has he forced his opponent to move back away from what would have been a very, very powerful kick, but he's forced him back right against the fence. So he's now restricted his options. And he's looking at his opponent thinking, this guy's going to level change in a minute. He's going to try and take my striking and my range away from me by putting me on the floor. So he rechambers the kick. So here's the first one. Remember where the back foot is. It's going to come flying through. Now it misses, but his opponent moves away from it. And Fajeda's going to replace that front foot pretty much right where his opponent's center of balance was before he forced him to move back. Then he's going to jog his back foot up to reestablish and refire the kick right at the same time as his opponent level changes onto what must be a really tasty shin bone. I mean, he got a big mouthful of it. I love this finish. It's just... wham. Plants the lead foot, skips through, kick to the face. And then sprawl straight off. And look, we see him playing this range against Sheffield as well, which, you know, it was another really, really impressive finish. A little bit like Pacheco when she was pressuring Kolesnik and she dropped back, moved her head away. We're going to see the same thing here, look. Because he's going to throw that straight right down the pipe and he's going to crack Sheffield on the chin. Sheffield's going to reply with the longest left hook he can. But it's still a good 6 inches away from Fajeda's chin. At the same time as Fajeda throwing the same extended arm and catching him clean on the chin as a counter. Like, this is the problem when you're dealing with this guy, is that he hits you and you throw your counters and they fall short and he's hitting you with follow-ups. Like very, very difficult to get close to him. And it's going to be interesting to see how Goltsov deals with that with his jab. Got a great jab, but you've also got to establish the range when you've got a great jab. And if he's doing that, he's always going to be at danger of the long-range strikes of Fajeda. The smart thing for Goltsov to do is to grab a hold of him and put him on the floor where he's nullifying that chaos in his game. But this is the area that, of course, Fajeda is going to be expecting Goltsov to try and force him into. So he's going to be doing everything he can in this training camp to make sure that he doesn't end up there. A really, really dangerous individual and someone that we're going to be talking about for years to come in the heavyweight division, I feel. Okay, moving on. So Sadabou C, probably the highlight knockout of the year so far, I think it's fair to say. Now, of course, Sadabou C, let me just pull this back. I left this clip a bit long because there's a nice storyline that builds up to this finish, the way that he kind of plays the fight up to this point. Now, of course, Sadabusiev's fighting Magomed Kerimov, who is a great striker and a great grappler. And if you're dealing with someone that's a great striker with great takedown defense, but you know once you put them on the floor, they're going to be uncomfortable, you've got to think that Magomed Kerimov is going to try and take the space away from Sadabusiev. It makes sense that he's going to try and use his striking to get into a close range where he can get his hands on Sadabusiev and take him down and then get to work on the floor where he's much less at danger. Kind of similar with Goltsov and Fajeda. Take away their strongest range. But that's easier said than done because Sadabusiev has got excellent takedown defense. It's something that he's developed a lot over the last few years, and we've seen that in his recent fights, especially in his fight against Carlos Leal, where he was constantly up against the fence trying to create space for himself. Now, against Shane Mitchell, we saw him dealing with pressure constantly because Mitchell knows that he's got to get inside the long range of Sadabusiev. So C was doing this really good job of just kind of extending the space between them. Extends the space and forces Shane Mitchell to close the range himself, walk through the fire, through the danger zone. And having spoken to Sadabusiev earlier this week, he was talking about a highlight reel knockout. He had something in mind. And when you've got someone that is so eager and almost under duress that they have to close range because they don't have another choice in this fight, it's easier to set people up for something specific, especially if you've got a good game to support the crescendo finish. So Sadabusiev, of course, is an excellent kickboxer. He's got really, really good kicks, and he worked the body of Shane Mitchell really well in this fight anyway. But he kept testing the spinning head kick. The kick that he finished the fight with, he kept testing it. Now, what we're going to see is this snappy left leg. Every time there's an opportunity, you just kept snapping it into the ribs. Here's the back kick that landed well. Now, the reason why I left this in is just because I want you to pay attention to the posture of Shane Mitchell right now. Now, this is early in the fight. Currently, right now, Shane Mitchell is prioritizing defense of his head, I would say, right? Most important thing. Defend your head. He's also using the lead arm to sweep anything that's attacking his body. So he can use this for front kicks, for turning kicks. He can use it for back kicks as long as he's got the timing down. But what it does do is it keeps drawing his attention to his midsection, which is already being softened up by Sadabusiev. And in the process of this, C starts throwing in these spinning head kicks, these hook kicks, reverse hook kicks, spinning hook kick, whatever you want to call it. And here's the first one. And now you can see this one, it just kind of skips off the side of his head. Just kind of slaps him with his toes, which is not ideal. It's not ideal. And what we do know is that the range wasn't quite right. And I'm watching this back foot stepping back slightly. Sadabu's going to keep adjusting this range between him and his opponent because what he's trying to do is he's trying to get him to move into the range of the kick. But the point where the kick lands is, I mean, it's the Goldilocks zone. It's such a narrow window to land it perfectly, which is why it's a difficult kick to land. So a few times C tries it and it wasn't successful, this being one of them. And you can see here, look, you can see how he's just slightly out of range because the foot is landing. What you'll notice with this kick and with the one that finishes the fight is that the heel lands on the one, the fight finisher. It's a much cleaner hit. Here's another one that he tries from a different angle. Same kick, just not quite the same connection that he wants. Bang. Little bit closer this time. This is a bit less foot. But what you will notice as we get to the right angle, there we go, is that you'll notice that his heel is still in the palm of his opponent's hand, which means that it still missed his face, which means that he's still getting slapped with toes around the side of his head and potentially on the guard. He's still a couple of inches too far away to land this kick with the right purchase that he needs. But of course, he's going to make the adjustment. Beautiful. And look at the little jog back that he does. Watch his feet. Pay attention to his feet. There's the jog. Little jog back. Encourage Shane Mitchell to follow him, plant that back foot, and then go. And as the foot lands, you can see from this angle even how much closer he is with the heel. Now the heel is landing. So not only has he corrected the range of the kick, but he's also, in between these attempts, he's been softening up the body, so you can see the body of Shane Mitchell is bruised and damaged. And if we go back to the point where he's receiving the kick, you remember the guard at the start of the fight was here and here. Now it's here because his ribs are sore. His ribs are stinging and bruised, which means that now there's no glove here. And Sadabusi's adjusted the range. So he's softened him up to the body, he's forced him to drop this backhand, and then he set him up perfectly for the head kick. So when he does finally land the kick with the right part of the foot, which is the heel, it goes right over his fingertips and right into the side of his head above his ear. I mean, like, you couldn't write it better. It was just a beautiful finish. And because of the damage that Mitchell had taken to the ribs, he was susceptible for this kick because he was subconsciously prioritizing. Look where his hands are. He was subconsciously prioritizing protecting his bruised body. What are those fingertips going to do here? They're going to do nothing against the Sadabusi heel. He's not making this decision consciously. This has been made for him based on the pain that he's feeling in his midsection and the fact that he's being triggered to respond by the movement of Sadabusi. Lovely, lovely, lovely finish. But of course, he's fighting Magomed Kerimov, who is most likely going to close him down. Now, Kerimov is a great striker. He's a very slick striker, but he uses his striking to set up his takedowns. This is a lovely setup here. Fires the right hand onto the chin, lowers his level at the same time, and then wraps and drives through. Okay, pulls that leg close to him, drives, and now he's on top of his opponents. And then from this position, again, very, very right hand dominant. Everything is post and punch and post and punch. He really, really does like to focus entirely on forcing people to deal with his right hand. And you know, if they do sit up into the wrong position, of course, he has got good submissions as well. But we can't neglect his striking, especially because I do feel like this might be more of a striking exchange than we're anticipating. Now, this combination against Ben Egli is really nice. So we're going to see two swiping shots. We're going to see a right hand come swiping over the top, and then we're going to see a long swiping left hook. And they both kind of land, but Egli's got his guard up, so he doesn't take the punch's full power. There's the first one while he's on one leg throwing a kick. Kind of knocks him off balance, gets his attention. There's the swiping left hook, kind of punches his arm out the way. But as this is happening, Magomed Kerimov's moving himself into a closer range, resets his feet. Bang. Now he's ready to throw that punch again. He's very good with his footwork. I mean, there's two resets here, actually. There's the first reset and then the second reset before he throws the right hand. And now you've got to remember that he's drawn Egli's attention to that right hand. And this is, I mean, you know, we're seeing this more and more in mixed martial arts as a favorable finishing technique. But as Egli's been hit with the right hand twice, the second one being, you know, consequential, what we're going to see from Magomed Kerimov is he's going to fire this right hand straight down the pipe to draw the attention of Egli towards that center channel, right? Bring his hands to cover himself and keep him safe here. At the same time, he's going to throw something around the side to capitalize on the fact that the guard is now not here, it's here. Right hand comes out. Kick comes around the side. You can see the arm is in front of his face. He just doesn't have enough time. He even sees the kick, but he just doesn't have enough time to get it around the side of his head to cover it. Where are we? This other angle's wicked because you see the jaw of his opponent move. So there's the punch. The punch connects, but there's not a great deal on it. But what it does do is it draws the backhand of his opponent, punches him right in the forehead. His fist is going to move into the center of his face because that's where he's just been hit. At the same time, the kick is coming around the side to catch him in the side of the head. Pow. Lovely. So basically what I'm saying is like you can't underestimate this guy anywhere. Like, and I guess this is the same for the light heavyweight bracket as well. Nah, maybe not. In the light heavyweight bracket, you've got Josh Silveira who controls the kicking range and the grappling range. Impa Kasanganai controls that space in the middle. So Josh Silveira can keep it here or he can keep it here, right? It's slightly different for Magomed Kerimov because he can be competitive at this range where Sadabusi is. They can both be competitive here, but there is an advantage clearly here for Magomed Kerimov. So Sadabusi's got to keep it up this end of the spectrum. He's got to keep it in his range. Magomed Kerimov can play both ranges, which makes it easier for him to transition from one to the next. He can throw punches to a level change. He can feint a level change and come up with strikes. It's far clearer that Sadabusi isn't going to be trying to grapple in this fight, but it doesn't make it clear what he's going to have to deal with on his opponent's side. Now, I think we're going to the light heavyweights now. Look at that. So Impaka Sanganai, as I was saying, this range, short range punching power and footwork, he's competitive with anybody on the planet, especially at light heavyweight when he's very, very fast compared to some of these bigger guys. So like I said, if you're very, very close, if you're in the grappling, the wrestling range, this is where Josh Silveira is most likely going to excel. But if Impaka Sanganai stands out on this range, he's going to be dealing with the kicking game of Josh Silveira. But when Kasangane moves forward and moves at speed with precision and picks his shots to know where he's going to land his power punches so he's not wasting his shots, it's so difficult to deal with someone of this kind of precision and athleticism. Honestly, I mean, it's like, this is a beautiful move. He's going to step in and he's going to tempt to the body. See, like, it's not even a touch to the body. His intention is not to land that punch. But because he makes such a good job of lowering his level as he steps in, you can see there's like this hesitation from Hamlet here. It's like he doesn't know whether the shot's going to come over the top or through the center. So when it comes through the center, then he starts to readjust his guard as Kasanganai starts to then build up the body for his power shots. So watch this. Short right to the body. Not really important, because you can see he's already chambering the left hook to go. The left hook's going to go, but it's just going to skim the top of the face of Martin Hamlet. But this point, Impa's planted his feet. That power back foot has planted. So when he throws this right hand, look how much closer he is now than where he was. Look where he was. Look where he is. He's moved himself into range safely by feinting with his lead hand. Tap, tap. Touch into the body. Touch into the head, and now he's moved himself into range for where the two power punches come through. Right hand, left hook. Sick. Sick. Bat, bat, bat. So fast. So fast and so crisp as well. Like, you can see Hamlet trying to react with his arms. He's kind of not sure where the arms are going to go, but with these 4 ounce sleeping pills, you can't cover everything. Something's going to get through. And with the hand speed of Kasanganai, like his ability to punch his opponent, the right hand does the damage. There we go. That's the knockout punch. Bam. Hamlet's already on his way down here. But as he's falling, Kasanganai's still able to catch him with another shot and another clean left hook as well. What a beautiful finish. Really, really nice. Very slick. And one of the fights I'm most excited about on the card, because it's a very, very difficult one to call. Like, Josh Silveira's got a great kicking game. Here he is against Martin Hamlet, same opponent, using this kicking game to bring himself into his grappling game. But let's look how he sets this up. So you can see he's kind of got Martin Hamlet backed up out of punching range. He's going to throw this kick to the midsection, front kick to the midsection. Then he's going to go same again. He's going to reassure his opponent that that's his focus. Front kick, front kick. Look at what Hamlet does with his hands. Hand down, right? Head is an open target. Then from the other angle, we're going to see him do the same thing. We're going to see him show the same thing. We're going to see him bring his knee up. But now, obviously, because we're watching the replay and we're slowing it down, we can see as this kick starts to trigger, we see a twist in his hip. And Hamlet drops his arms to block low, and the kick comes around the top. There's nothing defending above the head, above the shoulders, which leaves his head open for that beautiful head kick. Lovely. And then footwork circles around, takes his back, lands a few good shots. you can see him drop his arms there. That's an even better angle, really. You can see as the kick comes out, as he recognizes that the hip's moving, Hamlet's arms actually come down to try and meet a body kick, which is not there. And the head kick goes straight over the top. And then, you know, Silveira, a great wrestler, Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, his father Conan in his corner. He jumps on someone's back. And, I mean, you know, and this is very, very consistent. He's got such a really good rear naked choke. So to summarize in this fight, if I'm Impaka Sanganai, I want to be in that sweet spot where I'm just inside the kicking range, but not close enough to be clinched and taken to the floor. Kasanganai can use his close range footwork on the inside and his fast hands to make that range very dangerous for Silveira to be reaching to try and grab. if he gets too close, he might get tangled up, and then that's where we're going to see how his takedown defense is holding up against Silveira's. If it hits the floor, then of course we're going to have to see some of Kasanganai's scrambling and submission defense. But the smart range for him is clearly in the boxing range. If I'm Silveira, I'm going to use the kicking range to try and get it to the grappling range if I can. But again, two guys that are soaring at the moment and have both very, very much impressed me this year. And I'm just kind of excited to see how they show up for the championships and what else they've added to their game to try and get the better of their opponent. Because you've got to remember, these guys have shadowed one another for this whole year, watching each other. They're faced off now. Like, they have a good idea of what they're up against or what they think they're up against, which is always the interesting thing. Okay, I think we've got one more, haven't we? I think we're just main event, just the top one. Here we go. So, OAM. Now, one of the more calculated and technical fighters in all of mixed martial arts, and you would expect it from this guy. I mean, he's a very intelligent individual. He's very good at kind of reading his opponents and seeing the easiest route to victory without exposing himself. Very good at playing the long game. Really suits the PFL format because he's going to be keeping himself safe in his fights. He's not getting into wars and picking up cuts and bruises that are going to follow him through his career. Like, this fight against Stevie Ray was a really impressive one-sided control because he was able to dismantle the lead leg of Stevie Ray and take away his movement. And because he's fighting Clay Collard, who is he's the MMA version of being waterboarded. I mean, he is in your face constantly, working the body, coming up to the head. He's a boxing spoiler. You know, he's the guy that they put in against these upcoming pros that they're trying to keep undefeated, and then, you know, Clay Collard's handing them losses, the first losses of their career, because he's a veteran of the game. He knows how to play this game very, very well. And whatever OAM does in this fight, he has to take away some of his movement and his enthusiasm, because otherwise he's going to be dealing with Collard at full pace for as long as this fight lasts. Now, Collard did have issues in his last fight with Burgos chopping into his lead leg, which is why it makes sense that OAM's going to do the same thing. First of all, he's got a very good low kick game, and second of all, he's seen it work against Clay Collard, who doesn't really have a low kick defense aside from let's keep throwing. Really good work to the end. We'll get onto Clay Collard in a second. Just watch the way that he takes away the lead leg of Stevie Ray here. So as Stevie Ray steps here, he sees that front foot step forward, and he's going to turn a hard calf kick into that lead leg, and I know that this is a painful one because Stevie Ray's leg doesn't move. His hip moves. Look how his hip moves from the impact of that kick. That means that the whole force of the kick was taken into the muscle, which is going to be far more impactful. You remember the Pinedo defense where he was picking his leg up? It's not ideal because it does still throw your base off and take away some of your counter punches. But it does mean that you're not taking the kick into the meat of the leg where it's going to have the most damage. This scenario is different because Stevie Ray is moving forward to counter or to punch, which is exactly what Clay Collard's going to do. So his lead leg is going to be planted, which means it's going to take the brunt of the power of this low kick. And because of the way that OAM throws this, it's the shin that's digging into the calf. It's different to a low kick. It's a new technique that you really have to drill separately. You can see the position of the legs of OAM. He's almost like he's still kind of facing forward, but he's using this lead shin to dig into that calf, which is going to hit that perennial nerve, and it's going to deaden that lead leg of Stevie Ray, which is kind of what we start to see happening. And he's really hacking into it at this point, which makes Stevie Ray annoyed. It makes him chase more. It makes him put more weight on that lead leg, more eager to close distance. And then when OAM switches up his game plan, you can see by Stevie Ray's face that he can see the punch coming. He knows this punch is coming, but he's already in range. He doesn't have the lead leg to push himself out of range at speed. He's most likely distracted by the pain of his lead leg and also considering what else he's going to have to deal with or when he's going to have to deal with that calf kick again. He may have been anticipating another calf kick and been thinking about countering with his own hands, which is why he's so close into range. But what it does do is it leaves him vulnerable for this lovely long hook from OAM. So if I'm OAM fighting Clay Collard, I need to damage that lead leg. I need to slow him down, stop him marching me down. Like, Burgos did a good job, but you can see what Clay Collard does. He punches over the top of everything. So even when Burgos was kicking him, he was still put under pressure, dig. I mean that is pretty much the same clip playing out in a slightly different way. So we get an inside low kick. Shane Burgos backs up, switches his stance. Little inside low kick. Southpaw pull. Moves himself away from the body shot. Lets Clay Collard move into range, and then he's going to pivot this way and throw a right hook counter. It's beautiful. Lovely little turn, hook, bang. So, like, if I'm OAM, I'm looking at this clip specifically and thinking, well, I could probably catch him with that. I caught Stevie Ray with that. I could probably catch him, especially if I take his lead leg away, which Burgos has done a good job of in this first round. But look, again, Clay Collard, the thing that he brings to the table is this pace, this drowning pace that he has where he's digging to the body. Really, really good at being in boxing range and putting his head in safe pockets where he's not taking too much damage. And then once he's worked to the body, once he started to sap his opponent's gas tank, then he starts coming back up to the head. And I can't undersell his head movement as well. This is from his focus on boxing, on being a boxer, on making money as a boxer when MMA wasn't an option for him. It's given him the confidence to be able to stand in boxing range and read where the shots are coming from and being able to roll underneath them and put his head in safe pockets that also gives him good opportunities to counter. And we see MMA fighters constantly neglect body shots. This is not something we see from Clay Collard. Look how he rolls underneath that shot there. And you can see Burgos throws it kind of chambered because he kind of knows he's probably going to miss. There's a deep roll, and then he hooks to the body straight off the roll. It's really nice boxing technique. And he's going to keep doing the same thing. He's going to keep walking him down, tap, 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 couple of digs to the body, keep coming up to the head. And on this shot, you can see how it starts to pay off because he's going to go. He's going to let Burgos come in. He's going to dig a couple to the body, bang, bang. Burgos' arms are going to drop, and then he's going to come up to the head and hit him with that lovely slicing hook before Burgos is able to bring his hands back up to his chin. Honestly, like he's one of those kind of guys when you're watching him, you're like, oh, I bet he just never stops when he's sparring. I bet he's working constantly. Like Sean Strickland, another good example, someone that just is confident to stay relaxed and walk into range and just pepper you with shots that aren't particularly fast and are not particularly powerful, but are voluminous and exhausting and come from a variety of different directions and hit a variety of different targets. So with these little gloves and no space to go, you're just going to get eaten up. OAM's got to debilitate that lead leg. Then he's got to stay on his bike so he can force Collard to keep planting on that lead leg and utilize his straight attacks, maybe even start setting up some takedowns. But if Clay Collard's able to get close to him and start to smother over those low kicks and force OAM to work at a pace that he's not necessarily comfortable at working at, or not normally forced to work at, maybe a better way of putting it, that's when we might start to see cracks in his game. That's when you have to stop thinking and start doing. And whenever you leave OAM to think, he's dangerous. If Clay Collard forces him to do, we might see some holes in his game, and that's where Clay Collard is able to find his way through. Make sure you tune in for these fights. I will be cage side. I will be looking forward to these. I'll be working the Telestrator. We've got great championship fights. We've got Kayla Harrison back on the card. Lots to look forward to. Thanks for joining me. Enjoy these fights, and I'll see you next time.